start, and that way it'll be on that too. Okay, so last week this week is Chol Hamoed Sukkot, October 17th, 2011, Sefer HaChinuch. Last week we asked some questions. So the one question that I have the real answer to, which it looks like we'll see a little bit of that reflected in this week's learning, is how can you offer a korban on somebody else's behalf, right? So it's only for that group of four called the Mechusare Kapara, which is the Zav, Zava, Yoledet, and Mitzora. So it's those four. So those four already did whatever atonement they needed to do. The Mitzora, the leprous person, so obviously it's not leprosy, the one who's manifesting the physical malady that's the reflection of the spiritual problem. So they already were separated, quarantined, diagnosed, quarantined, tshuvah'd, and returned,
except do the sacrifice.
And mikvah'd,
right?
But they still don't have kapara. So they're called a mechusar kapara at that stage. They can't go into the Beit HaMikdash, and they can't eat holy things at that stage. But they've done their tshuva. They're set except for that last piece, which is sort of, you know, allows the coin to go down, sort of. But they're set, really. They did their work. And a zava and a yoledet are three different categories, actually, from the Mitzora, in that they had some type of an issue, physical issue,
like
from
a
them, a discharge, or a baby,
right?
That exited their body, but had nothing to do with Avera.
Okay.
Right.
Right.
Had nothing to do with this.
Right.
It was a physical thing that happened to them.
That created.
So
the
in the one case, the kapara is the tshuva is already done, so there's no sin attached. And then the other three cases,
there was no sin
attached.
Okay.
It was a physical thing. So what's happening is that it's not, unlike other korbanot, it's not a korban that you need kavana for, because it's not part of a process of tshuva or of thanks. It's not a korban that's a thank you korban, and it's not a korban that's an I'm sorry korban. So what kind of korban is it? So that's Ad Kan, was from Rabbi Yoel Unger, that you don't have to have the dot, because it doesn't have to do, you don't have to have physical, you don't have to have knowledge that you're doing it, the dot, that you're doing it, because it doesn't have to do with anything in your brain. It has to do with a physical thing that happened. So, and the same thing with Mitzora. It is a physical thing at this point that happened. They had something, and for that, they need the korban. So, so how does that work then? So now it's just up. Now it's my speculation, because I didn't get to ask this follow-up question, because it was a quick exchange. I asked him one day, and he checked it out for me and looked it up. But these were like in-shul exchanges, because it's Yontif. But really, the follow-up question is, how does that work then? Is there a quote-unquote, and it's the wrong word to use, but you understand what I mean when I say it, is there a magic there? Right? So it seems like there sort of is. And I need to find a better word. I'm open for suggestions and would appreciate a better word than magic. But in thinking about that concept, that things work because things work, like there is a principle there that works, that all you have to do is do the thing and the thing works. Right? So that's what's happening here, is you do the korban and the kapara comes. And you don't even have to do the korban yourself. It just has to be done on your behalf, which is sort of like a incorrectly used word, magic. Right? The same thing we'll see today for Yom Kippur, because the first mitzvah that we have today is that the Kohanim should enter. Oh, it's the second one that we want to look at. The precept of the temple service on the Day of Atonement. So there is, on the Day of Atonement itself, the day itself is mechaper. Right? So you do need a certain amount of kavana and preparation, but you also don't need that for certain averas. So for certain things,
you just have to physically do the thing.
You just have to go through the day. You have to be alive and live through that day. Fasting is, you know, and I'm not even sure if it works. It might even possibly work a little bit, even if you've chosen not to fast for certain things. I'm not positive about that. But the day itself offers atonement for certain things. Yeah.
So it would be a similar type of scenario, shall we
say. That's what I'm saying.
That
similar type of force that works without kavana being engaged does work. There are other examples of it. So the avoda in the temple, but the actual day itself, let's just take Yom Kippur as a day. Etzem Hayom Hazet is a phrase that's used around Yom Kippur. The essence of that very day atones. So just living through the day. So that's why somebody called me before Yom Kippur. somebody not so observant, but observant enough that they wanted to know, but they were calling me, not observant enough that they were calling me for their psak instead of a rub. So,
well, maybe they didn't have
maybe
else
not.
To call.
But anyway, so somebody who had recently given birth to a first baby in her late 30s or early 40s, I'm not sure of her age exactly. Anyway, so she wanted to know, like, what's her obligation in fasting? So the truth is, the obligation for fasting for Yom Kippur is you fast.
If you,
everybody fasts.
If you,
even if it's really, really hard, unless it jeopardizes your life or health significantly.
Health.
Significantly. So. So let's say you always get nauseous and a migraine headache, you fast. Right? Mm. Let's say, I just happen to know from one of our classmates, let's say you have a hip replacement and you can't get a bladder infection. You can't. It's not, it's so, it's life-threatening. It's limb-threatening to get a bladder infection, but you always get one when you fast. So let's say you're a healthy person and you always get one when you fast. You get it and you take antibiotics after. We live in an age where you can do that. But let's say you just can't afford it. So you have to drink on Yom Kippur a certain amount, and there's, you know,
whatever,
certain small amounts according to what the rabbi says, but you have to for that. But let's say, you know, you're pregnant or nursing, depending on where you're pregnant. It's interesting. So Rabbi Shragi Friedman's wife was due 2 days after Yom Kippur. She had to fast the whole thing because it didn't matter if she went into labor 2 days before her due date. No problem. She could go into labor early. Once she's in labor, she has the din, the halachic status of a chola sheyesh basakana, a sick person whose life is in danger. Somebody in labor has that status.
Right.
Then you can do whatever you want. You can eat, you can drink, you know, as long as your doctor lets. Right.
You
then you're not supposed to.
Do it anyway.
Right. I don't hold by that. I eat and drink in labor. But, but right, it's a problem. Anyway, you're permitted at that point, halachically. So, but let's say, for instance, for Gitti, who was a month early on Yom Kippur,
for her to go into labor could be a
wouldn't
problem.
Have been good.
Right.
So Rabbi Friedman came over to Avi. Avi didn't even ask the Shabbat. It was so nice. Rabbi Friedman came to Avi and said, your wife's due a month before. Then this is what she has to do. Yom Kippur afternoon, she could fast the night and the morning. But then, she, you know, starting the early afternoon, she should drink an, just under an ounce every 10 minutes. And she can eat just under an ounce also every 10 minutes. So, so Gitti said that made her hungrier. She didn't like the eating part because you can't eat anything that like makes it. She had this little tiny Play-Doh parfait cup that they measured out. This was from a Play-Doh set. It was just under an ounce. So she could stuff that with food or fill up that with water. And so she had that. But it did keep her from going into labor. So that was good. And she got to wait the extra week, which is what she needed. Yeah.
So wait, going back to the magic. The magic?
Right.
So in temple times, it was where the korban was done was usually in the temple, right?
Only.
Only in the temple.
Only.
So
yeah.
It was, that would be easy then because it was the sanctity, the special holiness.
Yes, we'll see that too today.
Of the temple that sort of was the magic.
Well, it's the actual procedure. But we will see also today that you can only, that's the 186, not to ritually slay holy offerings outside the sanctuary forecourt. Mm-hmm. And you're not allowed to bring them either, so it's a separate mitzvah. But they can't be brought anywhere. During temple times, that's the only place. And now post-temple times, pre-temple times, there were places you could bring it.
Right. Certain
temple times could only be there, and post-temple times,
no
nowhere.
Place, right.
Nowhere. Not
right.
Allowed.
Right.
Only temple. Right.
Right. So
since,
no sacrifices.
No sacrifices
right. Anywhere,
at all whatsoever. Right.
Right.
So
so we understand that sense of magic, because that is the whole concept of the Shekhinah indwelling of the temple itself is kind of the magic, the sanctity, the high holiness of that whole area,
right?
The physical
so the,
area.
Right, so that the engagement in it does make a difference. I mean, it does have to do with our engagement in it. You
mm-hmm.
have to go there,
mm-hmm.
but for that korban, you don't. Somebody else can offer it,
mm-hmm.
right?
So
and then it makes that work. So you don't have to go there.
Yeah,
so.
But by virtue
but somebody went there.
Somebody did.
Yeah. Doing it.
Right.
They are sanctified. And I guess, again, the concept of, you know, one Jew.
Right. There's a revus, a revut,
yeah,
right?
So
mixed
right.
in with each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And we see it today, although not working that great, although it probably is working pretty well, but we've got social problems because of it. But the concept that we sort of agreed upon, again, not working that great today. But the concept that we agreed upon of there are certain that the ultra Orthodox don't serve in the army. Why? Because there's different ways
right.
to protect the country.
Right, right.
Right. One is through being in the army, and one is through learning Torah. The learning Torah brings in a strong enough light into the nation that that should provide a protection too. Mm-hmm. That's the theory.
Right.
It's not, you know, I heard somebody talk about it. Somebody, right. So somebody, you know, on, there's Israeli, you know, Saturday Night Live type of, you know, Weekend Update type of shows mm-hmm. in Hebrew. So he said, you could see this concept is working because nothing bad ever happens in Israel. Right. So, however, probably not as much bad as might happen to you, but that's not something, of course, right. you could ever measure. How would you know?
I was going to say, it's the old negative, the double negative.
Right. It's not possible to see what the effect really is. But we definitely, and we also know that some people are learning without kavana or just to get out of it, but those people who are learning with true kavana and actually, so that does provide a protection to a level. possibly not strong enough for everything that ails us, but. So we do have that concept that there are things that you can engage in that make a difference for other people, for the whole nation. And the Lulav and Etrog is a really beautiful example of that, just to remind you of that. I just love this concept. So we have four species in the Lulav and Etrog, right? And it represents four different types of Jews. Mm-hmm. But they all have to be bound together for it to work, for the mitzvah to work, but for the nation to work. So they have either taste or smell or neither or both, right? So taste equals Torah, learning. And smell equals good deeds. So the Jews who have good deeds and Torah learning are represented in the Etrog. The date palm has no smell but has dates, so it tastes good, right? So that represents Jews who have Torah learning but no good deeds. And then the hadassim, the myrtle branches, smell good, but have no taste. They don't have a berry or any fruit that we eat. So they have smell, so they represent Jews who have good deeds, but no Torah. And the aravot, the willow branches, have no taste and no smell, represents Jews who have no Torah and no good deeds. And yet, the nation is comprised of all four types of Jews, and we all have to be bound together. This one atones for that one.
Could you please go over that again?
Sure. And my mnemonic I finally got this year, taste and Torah, because I always mixed up, you know, which represents which, so the TT, right? So taste and Torah. So taste and smell, those are the two things that they could have or not, right? So taste equals Torah, learning, and smell equals good deeds. So the Etrog has both, represents Jews who have taste, who have the Torah learning and the good deeds. The palm branch has no smell. It's not a fragrant tree, but it has, and it's not a fragrant branch, but it has dates, which taste good. So there you have taste, Torah learning, but no smell, no good deeds. And then the myrtle, the hadassim, has a lovely smell, even those little branches that we get have a nice smell, but they have no taste, no berries. So that's the Jews who have good deeds, but no Torah learning. And the aravot, the willow branches, have neither taste or smell. So those are the Jews who have neither. And they all four have to be bound together. The whole nation belongs together to accomplish the mission.
Okay, but can't leave anybody out. Four?
Four.
Well,
yeah.
That's four.
That's four.
The
Etrog
is one, and then the other three are together.
No, no.
Oh, there's only three species. And
three
species.
And that, and the fourth is the Etrog. Right. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, the four species is that includes the Etrog.
The Etrog.
Mm-hmm. And you know the story of the person who's going through customs, you know, and you have to declare, right, that do you have any fruit? So he checked yes, because he had his Etrog with him. So he checked yes, and he's going through, and they said, okay, what kind of fruit do you have? He said, well, I have a citron, which is the English word for Etrog. Mm-hmm. So I said, the customs said, a citron? Huh? I said, oh, I have to take you aside. Finally opens it up, and he looks at it. The customs guy looks at it and says, oh, an Etrog. I said, why didn't you say so? Go on. So apparently TSA and customs are both familiar with lulavs and etrogs, but they hadn't heard of a citron.
A car, that's what I
was
thinking of, a citron. Yeah, citron.
Right. Okay, so that's that. So and that question is, what's that too? I don't understand deeper parts of it, but I was considering it just a little bit, something to learn about, but I'll just leave you with a question about it. What is that, carrying a lulav and etrog? And in the davening, because as I was walking to shul this yontif, I was thinking, well, I'm not walking with a lulav and etrog. I'm shaking it. I'm doing that mitzvah. I pick it up and I shake it, mm-hmm. put it down, and I'm done. Why don't the guys do that? They don't. They take it to shul and they use it in their prayers. They walk around with it. They move with it. They hold it. What is that? And what's going on with that?
Where did that come from?
But there is, so I'm sorry that I can't answer the question, but...
she has the question.
But it does include some of the magic. Mm. There's something about holding it.
The waving
and all that stuff. And one of the results is, and I don't understand how this works really, but one of the results that our deeper sources say is that it creates fear in the nations for the Jews.
Mm.
Yeah. So tefillin apparently creates fear, and the etrog, the lulav and etrog,
creates fear among others.
Yeah, that others fear the Jews. Yeah,
the enemies of the Jews.
Yeah, the enemies of the Jews fear the Jews through tefillin and through the lulav.
Hmm.
So whether it's because the lulav is sword-like looking, but it's not just about the looks; it is about the energy of it that creates some type of a fear. So it is an interesting thing, whatever that means. So that's a place to go. I'm sure there's more in Kabbalah there, and I don't know it all. Yeah. There's all kinds of interesting stuff about the lulav and etrog in Kabbalah, about the lulav being the spine, and the etrog is the heart, and the aravot is the lips, and the hadassim are the eyes, about the shape of that. So that's easy enough to see, and then there's Torah about that. But then there's Torah about other body parts that they relate to also. It's all fascinating stuff. There's really interesting things in that. So unfortunately, I don't know all that stuff, but I do know that it exists, so... go and learn.
Go forth and learn.
Right? There's so much to learn, isn't it? It's really
exciting.
It is. I love it. There's always like a new frontier to try to get to.
Well, thank you for elucidating that. That was
sure. It's one little piece. There's a lot more to go. Okay. So now let's start with this, 184, that the Kohanim should enter the inner sanctuary only for the temple service. So that's an interesting bracha. A mitzvah. So it's a lo ta'aseh, shelo yikansu ha-kohanim, that the kohanim should not enter. So it's a lo ta'aseh. So the kohanim are not allowed to go into the sanctuary for any purpose except for service, and the kohen gadol is only allowed to go into the kadosh kadoshim, it's included in this, only on Yom Kippur, only four times. If he goes in a fifth time, he transgresses this. Or if he goes in on any other day of the year, he transgresses this. And any regular kohen, not just a kohen gadol, but a regular kohen who goes into the sanctuary, into the service area of the temple, for a reason other than service, transgresses this. So even though it's not really a place that a kohen who's tahor can't go, he's not allowed to walk through it.
Anytime. Except for service.
Except for during, for the purpose of service. And it's interesting... that he says, the way that he expresses it is fascinating, because usually, at the end of the mitzvah, he says, and this prohibition is in effect for men and women, in every time, or in temple times, or where it is, right? So this is how he ends it. Let's see. I'll read the last paragraph on 277. The rest of its details are explained in Tractate Talmud Menachot, and in the Midrash Sifra. It is in effect when the temple exists, for the Kohanim. Yet even now, when the temple is not in existence, our sages of blessed memory said that we are adjured not to enter the sanctuary.
Well,
okay.
How is that possible?
Right.
There is no sanctuary.
There is no sanctuary. They derive the matter from the fact that it is written, and I will make a desolate your sanctuary. So that's in Leviticus. That is a prophecy, saying that, unfortunately, your sanctuary is going to be made desolate. And it does not say, your sanctuaries will I make a desolation. I'll make desolate your sanctuaries, meaning your sanctuaries still exist even if they're desolate. Right? So that implies that their holiness remains upon them even when they are forsaken ruins.
So that's why you're not supposed to go up
that
into
being
the
so,
temple mount.
That's right. It is for me to list this prohibition among the bans that are in effect today.
So you're not supposed to go into the temple
today.
Mount.
That's right. Right. So this is that.
Well, then they can't even go in the tunnels either. They can't even
I'm not sure about that. I think you can.
The tunnels?
Yeah, you can go in the tunnels. I haven't heard from
it.
Right, they're not on
it. It supposedly gets very near the Holy of Holies.
But it's not.
Yeah, but that's
on
not
it.
In the sanctuary.
It's not in the sanctuary.
Okay. That's underneath it. Okay. So, and that's also a question of magic. Where does the Kedusha radiate to? Does
it
radiate
down,
up? Does it radiate down? Does it radiate sideways?
Yeah.
Where are you allowed to be? Having gone to the mikveh, not going to the mikveh. But as far as I know, nobody says anybody needs to go to the mikveh or do any special preparation to go on a tunnel tour. Everybody goes on the tunnel tours, Jews, non-Jews. You can just go on the tunnel tours, and there's no sign anywhere, and there's no
warning.
There's no warning, and there's no controversy over it. Should you go? Shouldn't you go? As far as I know, there may be in some small circles, but in general, the religious public goes on those tours. And the religious public in general, even permitted, would not go on the Temple Mount.
Right. But I remember hearing that when you could go up there.
A Kohen or a Levi, right? Pardon? This only applies to a Kohen or a Levi.
But that's in the sanctuary when the sanctuary exists.
But even now, a Kohen.
Even now, this applies to everybody. The prohibition for today.
Theoretically, if you could go on the Temple Mount.
So for those few people, right? So those, right? So now you know you're
not. I didn't know.
You won't do it again. But for those few people that the frum ones who occasionally do, some the settler types who are, and want to be Zionistic about claiming that it's not Zionistic. I guess there's a religious claim that they want to do, but they do prepare by going to the mikveh and whatever else they do before they go, and they don't go into the areas that are controversial. Look, they just to go up there, they go to the mikveh. And whatever else they do. There's not too many that go because, first of all, you're not allowed to, and second of all, it's whole problems, but whatever. There is some. For those who somehow make it, they do some kind of preparation. Yeah. But they do make some kind of preparation to be able to go up there, or I guess whether they sneak or not, whatever it is, they go.
Gotcha.
But they do prepare somehow because of this, because you can't just go. Right. Okay. 185, the precept of the temple service on the Day of Atonement. That the Kohen Gadol should carry out the entire service of the Day of Atonement in proper order. The offerings and confessions, the sending away of the goat, the rest of the service as it is written in the Sedra, for it is stated, herewith shall Aaron come into the holy place, and so on through the entire section. So, and the root of this lies the reason that God's loving kindness toward his human beings to establish one day a year for them for atonement of sins in accordance with the repentance that they will undergo. But it's more than that. It's more than in accordance with the repentance, because you could do repentance any time. But he plans this Day of Atonement. And it's interesting that it says that he says if he wouldn't have this annual day, then within 2 to 3 years, we'd build up so many sins that the world wouldn't be able to exist anymore. So it's interesting that it says that, and within 2 to 3 years. I think probably today we could do it faster. But
you think?
But anyway, we need this annual day.
Well, is it because people wouldn't do it on their own unless there was a day set aside?
It seems like not. So again, because the day itself atones. And that's what it says here, down towards the end of the second paragraph. And since God, blessed is he, designated that day for atonement, the day became hallowed and it received the force of purification from himself, be he exalted, so much so that it assists in the atonement. So the day itself assists in the atonement, the very nature of the day. And as it says, and the Day of Atonement atones. In other words, the day has power of itself to atone for light or minor transgressions. So that's without your participation. All you have to do is live in that day. Oh, so that's what I was saying about this girl who just gave birth. So, right, it's much better if you're not endangering life or limb. Let's say you're nursing. It's just very hard for you. Better you should stay in bed the whole day and not get up, not go to shul, not daven. You could talk to Hashem a little bit from bed.
So you're
but you need to live through the day.
Fasting,
that's your first obligation.
Fasting is the one thing. You can only do one thing,
that's it.
The thing you should do.
That's it, right. Better than go to shul, better than hold a sitter, better than stand up out of bed. If you're weak or tired or, expecting or whatever it is, and you are, for whatever reason, and it doesn't endanger your health.
Or the health of the baby,
right? Does not endanger that. It just makes it uncomfortable. Then you need to stay in bed.
It seems to me these days, like more and more people I know have health reasons why they can't.
I think so. We're weaker as a people. We just can't take discomfort.
Well, I think, I don't know if it's that. It seems to me like a lot of people I know are taking medication.
Well, yeah.
And so,
first of all, right, that is true. There are more baby boomers.
And you're taking medication. I mean, not me, thankfully, but
many people do.
A lot of people do, and you have to eat or drink or whatever to take the medication, and if you don't take the medication, there could be consequences for your health.
Right. So in those cases, you ask your Shaila, and you have to see, like, how much do you need it? Don't you need it? And then you take it according to what you have to. Some medications you can take dry, so you don't get to drink with it. You get to swallow it. If you can't swallow it with your spit, so you'll chew it. Oh, it's disgusting. All right, that's okay. It could be disgusting. It's Yom Kippur. You don't have to have a drink just because it tastes bad.
Yeah.
But you do have to take the medicine if you have to take it. Right? So depending on the medicine, if it has to be or not. So depending on many different factors. And you're right, Marlon, we are living longer and healthier, but with all kinds of assistive stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, this is the age of the baby boomer with all its, you know, and we're surrounded by all these people. That's why we're all in the same boat together, you know?
Right. Everybody has their stuff, right?
Seems like.
Yeah. And I mean, not everybody, but many people are taking a handful of pills in the morning.
A lot.
Yep. A lot of that's big pharma. I'm sorry. I mean, yes, I think some of it's assistive, and some of it is because they want to keep you keep you a customer. So it would be a big problem if they cured diabetes, because then you know, who would buy all their drugs?
Now they're going to create some artificial probiotics.
Right. That's necessary.
Don't get me started.
Yeah. I know.
Don't get me started.
Yeah, I live with these skeptics. I have two skeptic children who are skeptic of everything, and including Big Pharma, as if there was such a thing. So they're all over on that stuff. Yeah, it could be. Yeah. So something to not get started in. Okay, it's interesting just to look among the laws of the precepts. So let's look on the next page, 281, second paragraph, really first indentation. So just to see the count here, thus all the animals offered up on this day of fasting, except the goat sent away, which was not offered up, are found to be 15. The two daily offerings, the bullock, two rams, seven sheep, all ola offerings, two goats for sin offerings, one sacrificed on the altar outside and eaten in the evening, one sacrificed on the altar within and burned, and the additional young bullock for chatat sin offering. Now that I'm reading this, what does that mean, eaten in the evening? Who eats that? 14.
The priest.
On Yom Kippur?
At the evening. Oh, in other words, when it's over.
Or right before? Is it break the fast, or is it right before?
Well, I was thinking when it's over.
I don't know.
That you sacrifice it on Yom Kippur, and then you eat it when it's over.
Okay, well, that's a good question, isn't it?
And it doesn't have a footnote.
Right. I'll have to see what that means.
I count those in my own.
Because it's been cooked. I mean, they don't eat it raw.
Let's see.
I don't think there's anything in here about eating anything raw.
Two, three, four, five.
But if it's cooked.
And seven.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, if meat's cooked, it easily can be out all day.
You think?
15.
Sure.
No, the additional young bullock is 15.
Out all day?
You get seven.
It won't get spoiled.
It's one bullock.
No.
After
it's cooked, probably food can last 3 or 4 days if it's cooked.
Oh, I kind of love how they get that.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Sure.
Two daily offerings.
One sacrifice, that's 12.
Yeah. Two daily offerings is two. A bullock and two rams is five, and seven sheep.
So they really, really did do all these sacrifices and all these offerings. And I mean, this stuff really, really existed.
Really happened. Yeah, they really did. This is not allegorical.
For the whole time that the temple was there.
Yeah.
800 years.
Yeah, as long as they had animals.
Really?
Well, they bred animals specifically for this. Yeah. One of the trips that I went to Israel, and you've probably seen this. I don't know if you've been. Where is it? It's right outside Yerushalayim.
Oh, the Bell Coats? The Bell Cave?
Yeah, where is that? Coast? What's the name of that place?
Yeah, I know that's what you're talking about. I don't know, but it's fascinating to see these underground.
Right, it's a whole underground cave full of little
cubbies. Cubicles.
Yeah, little cubbies for the doves.
Right.
For the offerings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was just one of the
places
where they raised animals for this tree.
And collected there for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a whole thing about it. I mean, it's a. You know, just like today, whatever we want today. So there's a whole business that's around. How do we create what people need for their day? So people did that too. There's all kinds of business. People are enterprising. Raise the animals.
So now this says, and if it was this, none of the was to offer up the Musaf offerings.
And then here, the next paragraph down just talks about how the Kohen Gadol has to be married. That's just an interesting thing to point out, as opposed to some other religions. Our highest religious service official had to be married. It wasn't an option. He couldn't say, I'm sanctifying myself by abstaining. No, he has to be, because it says specifically, and he shall make atonement for himself and for his house. His house. So we know, ishto keveto, his wife is like his house. Right? So he has to have a wife, because that's who he lives in. She creates the environment for him. That's why she walks around him seven times under the chuppah. She creates his space. He lives in her. So he in his house, that's him and his wife. And then there's the other tasks of the service, changing the clothes from white garments to gold, from gold garments to white. Five
instances of immersion.
Virtual immersion.
On that day.
Yes.
Right, very clean.
Well, so that's what this is very important to see. It has nothing to do with clean.
Right.
The mikveh has to do with transition and status, and zero to do with clean. Because otherwise, why would you have to go so many times? What did he do? Right? He's putting on clean clothes each time. It's like a half an hour apart, an hour apart. Every time he goes. But what the mikveh does is create a transition in status, which in the Kohen then is represented in the garment that he wears when he gets out. So he goes from one garment to the next, but he needs the mikveh immersion in between to change his status throughout the day. Right, and then there's all the other things that he has to do. So that is listed here. So that's the precept of the temple service. So there is a whole long service that has to be done, and that's the order that it has to be done in, and that particular order is what's important. And it's not necessarily about, you see that this is has its misused word, magic in it. It's not about creating necessarily the kavana in the Kohen or in the people. The people don't even see it necessarily, what's going on,
so
all those transitions.
It's
about
it,
there
so.
Is a service, there is something physical to participate in which creates spiritual ripples which are felt by all, right? Which are absorbed by all, even if you don't feel it. There is the necessity of this physical avoda to create the spiritual environment in which everybody receives this atonement. So there is something that's necessary to do. Okay, 186, not to ritually slay holy offerings outside the sanctuary forecourt. So you're not allowed to certainly bring anything outside, right? Once we said, once there's the temple, then there are no other places outside the temple that any offering can be brought. But here, this is going further to say you can't even slay it. It's not like you could ritually slaughter it and then schlep it into the temple for its offering. No, it has to be killed in the right place. Why? Bottom of 283, at the root of the precept lies the reason, like Marilyn said, that the Eternal Lord, blessed is He, set a fixed place for the Israelites to bring their offerings and to direct their heart to Him there. Because of the permanence of the place and its glorification and its awe in people's hearts, their spirit would be influenced there for the good. The heart would be softened and humble to receive their heaven's kingship completely. Therefore, the Eternal Lord restricted us from sacrificing the offerings anywhere but at that place, so that there should be complete atonement for us. So basically what God is saying is He designated the place, but then He says, by your behavior at that place, sort of like today at the Kotel. How holy is the Kotel? It's a retaining wall. It just holds up a hill. That's it. Right? Basically, in terms of the physical structure, it's just a bunch of rocks with backfill in it that held the hill that the temple was built on. So it's not holy by itself, except for the fact that we've prayed there for so long. So our behavior has invested it with sanctity. And so that's what God's saying, is I'm going to pick this spot, but I'm going to make sure that your behavior, your concentrated efforts at that spot, you're not spreading out your behavior anywhere else. It's just at that spot. And that's going to infuse that spot with the kedusha that's necessary that you will achieve atonement by behaving in that spot. The sanctity will be there. And the following paragraph, I'll read, the crux of the matter is that all he commanded us is for our good, as we have written, because God has delight in the good fortune of his human creatures and in his great goodness. And so he said that whosoever will sacrifice an offering anywhere outside that chosen place, it will be reckoned for him as a blood crime.
Ooh.
Now, this is an interesting piece here. The reason is that the Eternal Lord permitted the flesh of living creatures to people for no other purpose than two reasons. Atonement or human needs. You can eat it or you can sacrifice it, but there's no other need to kill something. And you shouldn't go killing things for other purposes. So it doesn't say here fashion and things like that, but I think could definitely get that from here. I don't think that's the halachic ruling, but certainly the energetic underpinnings of this. Even though it's not like the spilling of human blood in view of man's superior level and the animal's inferiority, it is called shedding blood nevertheless, since the writ did not permit spilling it to no useful purpose. Therefore, it is stated generally that this is as the shedding of blood, since one spills its blood at a location where he was not commanded to slay it ritually, and there is no benefit whatever in that ritual slaying. Rather, there is damage in the matter, since he has transgressed the commandment of his Creator. Hence, Scripture gave his punishment as karet. So it's interesting. That's for slaying, ritually slaying.
Ritually slaying.
So you do get karet for that. But let's say hunting. So if you just, you're hunting for sport, which is
as opposed to eating.
Not okay, as opposed to eating. It's not okay, but you don't get curate for it.
It's
not a transgression, but you could see energetically here, not okay. This is not a Yiddish zach. We do not believe in hunting for sport because you're not eating it.
The only people that I know that hunt eat it. They hunt to eat.
Right, so then you're eating treif. So that's probably, right, I'm saying those people who do that, then they're eating treif animals, literally, because that's what treif is, right. Field torn, or nevelas, or they're eating things they shouldn't be eating, but maybe then they're not transgressing this.
They're transgressing some other.
Something else, right, but people who hunt just for sport, let's say those in the olden days, those who went to Africa to get the trophies, to have their zebra rug, to have their whatever it was, their heads
Jewish
of this or that.
No,
I don't think Jewish people did that.
Do you know something?
My father did.
Oh, did he?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's been a hard thing for me to deal with, is that he went to Africa many times.
Oh, really? Did he really? Oh, my gosh. Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh.
So, and when you've seen those animals in the wild, you think to yourself,
they're magnificent.
Oh.
So there's different cultures. So I think it's really important. I spoke with somebody who was sitting Shiva, and she felt so bad that her father, his whole life, didn't really give tzedakah, didn't eat kosher food, didn't really care about the Jewish people. She couldn't really find anything. Even sitting Shiva,
she couldn't find anything
redeeming. And she's like, "What is he like burning completely?" Like, right? Like she was just thinking, "What?
Oh,
what?
That would
what?
Be really hard to think that."
It was very hard for her. Very hard. So it's very important to know that. We don't know. And even if your father's still alive and you're still thinking about him, and he can, first of all, can still do tshuva alive. But we're raised, that's part of this generation and this generation and that generation's challenges is how do we connect Jewishly in a milieu of total disconnection? And we are glow-in-the-dark people because it's so dark, right? And there's different darknesses in every generation and different people have different abilities to glow. And sometimes... A generation's job, and I think it's changing this generation of the people in this room and certainly forward, but behind us, many people's job, not everyone, but many people's job was just to hang on, just to be
stay
a link
Jewish.
In the chain, to stay Jewish and
produce
progeny, right? Because it is really from us forward, we're moving into a different era right now, but we couldn't move into this era of Erev Mashiach and transforming the world unless we exist, right? So for some Jews, it was their job just to be Jewish and have Jewish kids. That's all they had to do. It would be better if they would have done more, but that was, they completed it by doing that. And there's reincarnations and all kinds of stuff. We can't make the chashbon. We can't make the calculation for any individual person, and we never, ever should. Which doesn't mean that we can't, with the knowledge that we're gaining, come back to somebody and try to gently bring them forward. And you might want to read, there's a very interesting book called Walking Mom Home. By Miriam Milhauser Castle.
Yeah, I want to read that.
And I think that would be good to read because it really talks about, I haven't read it, I just know her, so I'm admitting that, but I think I do want to read it. But it's really about her, about a year-long journey with her non-observant mother and the healing that happened in the relationship as she tended to her mother through her last year. By Miriam Milhauser. And she wasn't Castle yet at the time, so it's probably just Miriam Milhauser. She wasn't yet married, which allowed her at 50-ish to spend that full year with her mother.
She
did not have
married.
A spouse, yeah, and children. She did not have anybody else to care for besides herself. But one of the things that she did in that book is that there was a lot of healing, both in her relationship with her mother and then in guiding her mother towards her own, ability
to grow. The person has to be interested and want to do that.
Yeah, but I think that this book talks a little bit about the engagement of child and parent and the bringing towards that, even without the parent saying, "Oh my gosh, you've learned so much, please teach me." With the child saying, "There's stuff I would love to share with you, let's move forward a little bit," or, we're winding up towards the end here, what might you want to wrap up, what details might you want to, what holes might you want to close at this point, and then how could I help you with that? So, again, I haven't read it, so I don't know fully, but I think it might be something to work with. And then to always concentrate on what they have. They brought you into this world. And look what you can do, which you never could have done without him. Never. Okay. That being said, let's look at our last mitzvah for today, which is a very interesting one. 187, the precept of covering the blood in the ritual slaying of an animal. So I read the Rav Hirsch on this, and I'm glad that I did, because it's the precept is you slay an animal that's not a domesticated animal. So it's not, this does not apply to cows and sheep and goats, and it does apply to deer, the ones that we can't eat. So you can, a bison is a question mark. It has to be a chaya. We have two kinds of animals that we can eat, behemoths and chayas, and then there's oaf, the fowl, is a separate category. So fowl, we do cover the blood, and chayas, we cover the blood, but not behemoths. Behemoths are domesticated animals, and chayas are wild animals. Bison itself is a question mark. It's not clear.
Whether they're wild or domesticated. Yes.
Anybody who's seen a bison knows that they're wild, but halachically it's still a question mark. So so we treat it as both halachically today, meaning we don't eat the hind quarter and we do cover the blood. Probably the covering the blood is done without a bracha. I'm not sure about that, but since it's a suffix. But suffix animals, question mark animals, then you would treat as both, take the strictures of both. So you cover the blood. So what is that mitzvah? What is it about it? So, and covering the blood, how do you do it? So you do it just by sprinkling some dust on it. Afer, it's called afer, whatever that dust is. But it can be any dust. The first definition of dust is anything that a plant could grow in. But for the sake of this mitzvah, it can be anything that's dust-like, and it gives specifically the example of even gold dust, which clearly a plant couldn't grow in, right, but is dust. So any kind of dust. So it says clearly it's not about the dust, but it is about the dust. It's about a philosophic concept. So what is blood? Blood is that substance which holds the nefesh in the body. Animals have a nefesh and humans have a nefesh. So we've talked about the soul before. Human beings have a 5-level human soul. We call it the neshama. The bottom level of which, level number 1, is also called nefesh, so that's confusing. But below the soul, below the neshama, that 5-leveled neshama, is, and what holds it onto the body, holds it into the body, is the nefesh, the animal animating soul. Human beings have it, animals have it. It is not spiritual. It is the most ethereal of all physical aspects of us. So the animal soul is physical, not spiritual, but it's the life-giving force, and it's attached through the blood. So we don't eat the blood of anything that we do eat. Why not? And we not only don't we eat it, which is its separate prohibition, but we cover it. Why do we cover the sprinkling of the blood? The sprinkling of the dust on the blood. So why do we, it's called kisui hadam, covering the blood, kisui hadam. Why do we cover it? So Rav Hirsch explains that it is a concept, that we cover it, so that we should make the distinction between humans and animals. That here we are about to eat this animal, and we shouldn't eat the animal while seeing its life force on the floor. Right? So it should be separate. That should be separated. That we shouldn't. That could just lead to achzariut, to a bad character trait of unfeelingness, just like eating a mother and a baby on the same day. Like it's just, maybe, it's not, right, it's not, it's good just, for, yeah, us. We shouldn't do that. So there's that. But more than that, so that is one level. But more than that is the concept that we are both from the same stuff. Humans and animals are both made out of dust, except for we're not the same. And we don't want to confuse that we're the same. So while we're about to take into our body that which is the same as us, our flesh is made from dust, their flesh is made from dust, what we want to say is their life source, which is different than ours, their life force, which is different than ours, can only be made whole by going back into the dust. So their blood goes into the dust because their blood, their animating energy is only dust. It's physical. Ours is a divine soul, and we have to know the distinction between what gives them energy and what gives us energy. So even though we have that physical thing that gives us energy, what really distinguishes us between animals and humans is our neshama, our ability to transcend that physicality. And so that's the mitzvah of kisui hadam, because the mitzvah itself doesn't mean, if it becomes uncovered after you cover it, you don't have to cover it back up. And if and it can be any kind of dust. It's not actually about the covering that you can't see it at all. It's just a token covering. It's about the philosophic concept. It's a symbolic thing that what we're doing is covering that up. Let's see. Here, I'll just read the last paragraph from Rav Hirsch. The fulfillment of this command is meant to be the representation of a thought and not just simply an actual covering up of the blood. It is that's the case is quite evident from all the more precise laws governing it. For instance, the duty falls away in case of a nevela or a trefa. So if it's a non-kosher animal, I mean, if the animal is not shechted properly, but it's one of those animals, you don't have to cover it. It's not about covering the blood. It's about covering the blood of an animal you're going to eat.
So if you're not going to eat it, then...
Right, then you don't have to. That if it, and also that if it becomes uncovered, one doesn't have to cover it again. That according to be accepted by the halacha of Rav Yehuda, it's sufficient to cover up just a part of the blood. And it doesn't even require mixing it with the afer. It just requires that it has to be covered. So that is to about the contrast of the nefesh adam, the life force of the person, and the life force of the animal, that they are separate, as represented by the fact that we have this mitzvah to separate us. So once we're about to ingest the animal, then we need the distinction that we're not the same as them.
So when the animal is actually shechted in a kosher butcher, is there some sort of actual celebration or process or ritual where they actually do like a ritual covering of the blood?
Yes.
This is a non-domesticated.
So for cows, it doesn't apply, and sheep, it doesn't apply. However, for the bison, for bison and for fowl, they do. So I don't know how they do it in a huge, big factory with chickens. If there's a small portion, I'm not exactly sure how it's done.
Maybe like challah's taken a little piece.
Right. Do they do it, or do they have to do it with all of it? Do they like, how does that work?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how it actually physically shakes out. But let's just say in the olden days when the shechet comes to your farm, right? And they shech the chicken. So yeah, you have to like sprinkle a little dirt on that. Just pick up. You can just pick up from the ground. And I think there's a bracha to be said. So you just pick it up and sprinkle it on it. And yeah, that would be every time. Just to say, I'm different from that. Hmm. We do want to make sure, because we're so easily pulled into the animal. We can very easily be that. And so many, we've talked about it before, right? What's the difference between an animal and a vegetable, right? A vegetable plant reproduces, gets nutrition, reproduces, excretes whatever its CO2, its product, and so it has those functions. An animal does exactly the same thing. It's just that an animal is mobile, but its mobility is used just to eat better, reproduce better, excrete better. Right, human beings could be just glorified animals that we use our additional intellect.
Some people are.
Right, right. To be able to use our mobility to eat better, reproduce better, excrete better. Right, that's all we're doing. And there are plenty of people who function like that. So, and that's what the Torah is there for, is to say, I created for you.
You have more of a job than that.
Right. So that's that phrase we've talked about, Barasi Yetzer, Uvarasi Torah Tavlin. I created a Yetzer. And it doesn't say Yetzer Hara, it's just a Yetzer, right? I created the Yetzer, maybe it's Yetzer Hara, or maybe it's in both ways. Anyway, I created this Yetzer, this driving force, and I created the Torah as its spice, often translated as its antidote. But the idea is, Rabbi David Foreman says, as its spice, spice directs the flavor of something. Right? When you spice a piece of meat, you want to bring out a certain flavor that's in it. It's still a hunk of meat, but you want to direct the flavor. So that's what spice does. So that's what the Torah is. It's not that it spices up our life, but it helps direct us. We shouldn't just be a hunk of meat. We should have a flavor to us, right? And the flavor is transcendence of the straight-up animal. We shouldn't be straight-up animals. We should transcend that, use our free will to be able to transcend our animal instincts and be more than glorified eaters, reproducers, and excreters. You know, we can be more than that. That's what the Torah is there for. And that's what this mitzvah is for. And that's who we're supposed to be, is glow-in-the-dark people. So
thank you
full circle.
For my glow-in-the-dark star.
So yes, enjoy glowing and sharing the glow with other people.
You can
hang it. You could share it with people as a concept, show it to people that we are glow-in-the-dark people, but in order to glow properly in the dark, we need to absorb light. And that's what Sukkot is about, is absorbing light.
I'll be gone for a couple weeks.